of Atlanta for our we have a lot of strong runners, man. Like they go away from Atlanta and like crush it like all over the country. You know?
Well,
and
so besides yourself, and obviously you're a very humble gentleman, besides yourself, who comes to the top of mind that our listeners should know who they are.
Yeah.
I'm asking you.
I mean, it's fascinating to me. We had, you know, when I started running, which wasn't that long ago, maybe 2018 is like the first time I ever ran in my life. You know, I started running with like a group over at the Chattahoochee over at Cochrane Shoals. So you had like Allison Lear, Ben Mercer, Andrew Catanese, Evan Dare, Kevin Lammers, just a, you know, a group of guys and some badass girls too. And like, and just over the years, sort of tallying the races that people have won both in the Southeast and also, you know, all over the country. It's been pretty cool. It's like, what is it about these Soap Creek mountain bike trails that makes people strong runners, you know, like, yeah, it's been awesome.
So audio listeners, my mouth just went agape because I think just being an ultra runner that recent is one thing. The fact that you've done sort of master's school of, you know, kind of 100+,
yeah,
I think is kind of insane. Like people listening to the, okay, people who are runners that listen to this have some concept. For people who don't, like, I'm sure you've run into people. So when I did when I signed up for my first 100 miler, okay, which I DNF'd, yay me.
Well, which 100 miler?
Well, it doesn't even happen anymore. It's called Thunder Rock.
Okay.
It's put on by people who put on a bunch of races.
Sounds intense.
In Tennessee. Beautiful. Yeah. Like, I was like, I mean, like any good DNF, when I look back at why, it's like, oh, I didn't train hard enough. You mean, that's almost every reason, right? Unless it's like, I mean, it could be stomach issues, but you know what I mean? First of all, tell these people what you are making. This is a fantastic concoction happening in front of me.
This is a tea called yerba mate. I'm sure you're familiar with yerba mate.
I mean, I am. You're just, I'm just going to set the stage, ladies and gentlemen. If you said, I'm going to give you a man, okay, he's going to be the avatar of a fucking trail runner. Okay, I'm just going to go ahead and describe who...
Avatar is my favorite shit, by the way.
The movie?
I like the series. I like the cartoon series. Okay. But my goal in life is to become like a Naruto slash Aang.
My son loves Naruto.
I mean, yeah.
He's obsessed.
Honestly, I started trail running as I was watching Naruto for the second time in my life, and it was like the motivation of how Naruto is and trains with his buddies and like, you know, how they all take care of each other and motivate and like never give up, that like me and Andrew Catanese, when we first started running together, we would just pretend and like, you know, talk about Naruto the whole time. So,
all right. So I want to.
Sorry to stop.
No, it's
your,
okay.
Setting the stage.
So, what is that contraption you're drinking out of?
You've got,
this is amazing.
It's a gourd full of, green tea, yerba mate, with a straw called a bombilla that filters out the tea. So you just keep pouring hot water in it. And it's highly caffeinated. So,
no, I've definitely heard of yerba mate. I want to show you my lock screen that my son made. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know who that is?
I can't see.
It's going to go away. Let's all have my stupefications on it. Hang on. Because I don't know these characters. He's actually into, so my son recently got into, he'll take like a meme and a clip from some anime, and he'll add like trap music to it. Like that's his thing now. And
like, that's like the coolest thing.
They're right, like 13 seconds long.
You know that's like the coolest thing in the world right now.
But
trap anime.
Right. But like, he loves it. And like, you don't have kids, right?
No.
Okay. So when you have kids, they want to show you stuff and you want to really show an interest, and right, they are cool, but they're so short that they're kind of over. Right. Like,
sure.
And sometimes like,
but you're talking about like the TikTok generation,
right? You know, right. But I mean, he's like, not even on TikTok. My okay, daughter is, sure. My daughter's 14. She's on it. He's sure, not, he could care less about right, social and whatever. I'm like, buddy, do you want me to share these videos you made? Like,
right,
I have got, you know, a decent following. People might, he's like, I don't care. He just likes, yeah, to make them. And like, he'll make a cool, like, beat drop one that's like 30 seconds long. You're like, son, that's impressive. But like, some of them are like 8 seconds. And I'm like, okay, whatever. But anyway, I just didn't know if you'd recognize it. There it is. Do you know who that character is?
No. Is it something from like Full Metal Jacket or something?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But he changed my screen. But I feel like, God, there's so many places to go. The fact that you just started running, which means when you did two laps of Run the ATL with Katniss.
That was within the first year of running, yeah.
All right, we're gonna get there, but I have to back up and describe the person sitting in front of me. So he's got what many call a toque. It's a winter cap. It's green. It is not expensive. He's got a nice. I'm gonna go ahead and call it an AT beard. You know what I mean? Like he's just maybe he's a month on the AT, right? He's got the T-shirt with the what do you call it? Flannel over, and then he comes with a. What do you call this?
Thermos.
A big thermos Nalgene, which could be cold, but it's actually hot to fill his this fucking thing. I got to take a picture of you drinking from that thing. Yeah. This is amazing. This is the most. Hey, turn it. Can you turn it sideways and hold the microphone? Maybe. It's amazing.
You want to hear what it sounds like?
Oh, hang on. Okay, we got to do a video. Hang on. Okay. It's kind of like a bong, a little bit.
It gets mistaken for a bong all the time.
Okay. Do cops pull you over?
No, but. And also anyone that would be in the know would know that that would be a ridiculous a bong load. You know?
All right.
I don't have that kind of money.
All right. So where did you grow up, Whit?
Atlanta.
Okay. What high school did you go to?
I went to Pace Academy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what neighborhood did you live in?
Vinings.
Okay.
Yeah. I was born in Ansley Park.
Okay.
My parents moved out to Vinings, which, you know, 36 years ago was like the countryside.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you were still in the perimeter, but like
barely.
And then, you know, that's where I've lived my whole life.
Yeah. Smyrna Vinings was kind of like not out there and now it's like a thing, but
it's a huge thing now.
Smynings, yeah. I think, believe we call it.
Yeah.
That's my buddy.
There's a lot of Vinings claimers. You know what I mean? You can be like way out. I would say Marietta almost, and you see like Vinings.
Right. And I grew up in Marietta. So in LA, there's this area called Beverly Hills adjacent.
Right.
Which is like how dumb can you be? Like they want to claim Beverly Hills.
Right.
So they're just, so then you just say, you know what I mean? So you're like, so Smyrna is like Marietta adjacent, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or Vinings adjacent, right?
Yeah. We used to play, my old band, we used to play in West Hollywood at the Troubadour a lot. And I was always thinking like, West Hollywood, you know what I mean? It's like Hollywood's not really like a geographic designation,
right? But do you know what West Hollywood is like as a thing?
No idea. I mean, those, you know, like when you show up to places in that context, it's like you show up, sound check, play the show. It's 2 a.m.
Right. So sleepy, like so specifically, where you're talking about is the very famous part of Sunset Boulevard.
Okay.
Or as my right like. Like if you're at,
I thought Sunset was like Whiskey a Go Go, Viper
right,
Room.
Right. What did you just say?
Whiskey a Go Go.
Right. But where did you play?
The Troubadour.
Oh, Troubadours. Yeah, that's further down.
Yeah.
So yeah. So Troubadours further down. I lived in LA for 10 years.
Okay. Cool.
So so the part that you're talking about. That leads up to that. My friend, when I first moved to LA, goes, this is the woohoo, we're on Sunset part of Sunset. Because Sunset goes all the way to the east.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? And it goes further down. But West Hollywood is like a gay mecca.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's like Midtown, but like on steroids. Own police department, own fire department. The police department has like the colors, like the gay pride colors on the cars. So West Hollywood has its own thing.
It's very dystopian.
but like this is like in the 90s. This is like now you wouldn't even be surprised by it almost. But anyhow, so you played what instrument growing up?
Guitar.
Okay. Yeah. I don't want to give you your favorite. I want to know your top three or five guitar heroes.
Oh, well, Trey Anastasio from Fish.
Oh my God. I already don't like you.
Would be my, which, you know, is a deeply held secret. My Fish fandom for most of my music career, because I played in a punk band.
Okay.
So like I was a secret.
Just three chords and the truth, as we say,
pretty
right?
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. We were actually a folk punk band, which was a, interesting subgenre of like Americana punk music, basically.
Interesting.
But yeah, I played guitar. My dad taught me how to play when I was just a kid.
All right, but we need to go some more. So Trey.
Yeah, Trey. Jerry Garcia.
Get out. Stop. All right. Stop. Anybody? Any punk guys? Any Johnny Ramone in there? Any anything?
I mean, they're not great guitar players.
I know. That's what's beautiful.
It is. It is beautiful. You know, but no, I mean, the guys that impress me, like playing the guitar, are guys that I can't play as well as, you know.
So did you worship like Yngwie and that stuff?
No, not so much. You know, and like the punk I was listening to when I, you know, from the time I was like fourth grade, it was like, you know, Green, like Dookie came out, Green Day's album changed my whole world.
Right.
And then it was all the like Bay Area, Lookout Records,
right?
The Queers, Screeching Weasel, the Ramones, like all the like bubblegum stuff, you know? And it was like, for some reason I couldn't digest anything like abrasive. So like stuff that I hear now that I'm like, that's pop music at the time. Like if they had like the scratchy, like punk voice, I was like, it's too heavy, you know? Like,
so I'm like older than you, and yeah. I grew up in the 70s and 80s,
yeah.
And just pretty much the pop experience, right? Like, yeah. When I go back and listen to how fucking depressing 70s music is,
yeah.
It's really depressing, okay? Like, have you ever heard, like, Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue? Like, that kind of song is just like, you want to kill yourself, yeah, sure. Right? So
I mean, I hate the Eagles, you know.
So do I.
And now, you know.
Do you know, remember that song?
No, I don't know.
Don Henley Must Die.
But I mean, honestly, like, I'll throw on like Desperado and be brought close to tears. I mean, you know what I mean?
But remember that song? I forgot who sang it. Don Henley Must Die. I wish he'd take his friend Glenn Frey.
No.
It's by a punk band. I forget what it was. Yeah. But anyway, so, and I just grew up kind of with whatever was out there for the most part. My older sisters had like Led Zeppelin and stuff. But I'm getting to a point with the story,
okay.
That my friend gave me the Ramones, yeah. And it changed my life.
Yeah.
Like at 16, 17, or 18, these guys were speaking to me. I've never been the same since.
And what, like at the time that they were coming out, like late 70s?
No, I'm not that old. Okay. This is like 88, so they're kind of towards the end.
Okay.
Right? Still a couple good albums to go, but yeah. They're 10, 12 years into their fame. But I'm saying I probably heard Sheena is a punk rocker on the radio, but these songs were just fast and 3 minutes and then the next one and the next one. And they just like literally changed my life.
Yes.
So I relate to, and then of course I went down the line, Sex Pistols, Buzzcocks, Clash. I kind of went down the, I think those are kind of the holy trinity,
of course.
If you will,
yeah.
Of what I would call, like, I don't know what I call Green Day, and I love Green Day. Like those guys, like I grew up with those guys. Those guys are my
pop punk.
Yeah, and those guys are my age. Like Billy Joe is probably 50, like I almost am,
yeah.
Right? And I, dude, like I listen to American Idiot probably on a run like twice or three times a month.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's a good one for a run because it's got the it's kind of like a concept album. So
right.
Like, you know,
you just go
to the crescendo of the whole thing.
Right. But like, I find myself like if you try to keep a pace, right.
Yeah.
And then like you hear a song and you just like go fucking off. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I actually don't, you know, you would think listening to punk when you run is like is what you would want, right? Because it's like fast, it keeps you like energized and stuff. But like, it's actually the stuff that your son's brought, like the emo rap, like
right.
Emo trap, like sad boy rap stuff that like really gets me going.
So Jackson turned me on to Juice WRLD.
Yeah, exactly.
Fucking love me some
Juice
WRLD.
That's what I'm saying, man. And for some reason, it's those like low frequencies, like banging in your earbuds that like keep me pumped when I'm running.
I can
punk like for some reason it like. It's hard to keep a reasonable pace if I'm like listening to something super fast and
right.
And loud, you know, but
Juice WRLD can make me cry because he like basically like lived his lyrics and died his lyrics. You
all
know
of
mean?
Them, you know, Lil Peep, Young
all,
Lean,
all the Lils,
all of them, man, they're all dead.
They really are. We have a lot in common, Witwise Bram.
Yeah, man. And honestly, you know, we're jumping all over the place. I'm sorry. It's probably me. But that Run the ATL race was actually like a big turning point in my life. Just so you know, I mean, that was I had just come off of a divorce and had just started running. And that race was the first time, you know, I'd ever gone that distance. And to be like in my home city racing like that, like, you know, when I was younger, I used to do like the Alley Cat, you know, I was really into the fixed gear bike scene and, you know, riding all over Peachtree and all over town. And we would do those Alley Cat races where it was like, you know, kind of informal, and you know, you'd get like instructions as you go, like have to like hit these checkpoints and stuff. And it really, running that race at that point in my life was sort of like a breakthrough for me with running, you know. So yeah, just so you know that. And it was also where I reconnected to Allison Lehrer, who we had gone to Hebrew school together at the temple down here on Peachtree, but hadn't seen each other in, I don't know, decades. And at that race, she recognized me and then just kept bothering me until I came out and actually started running with people. I had been running alone for, you know, up to that point. So that whole event was like this breakthrough moment, man.
Well, first of all, so I'm kind of honored that you said that.
Yeah.
And the whole concept behind that race was honestly an idea that a friend and I had. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't it be fun if we just ran the whole Beltline finished or unfinished?
Yeah.
Right? And I'm standing on the shoulders of giants because what's-his-name had done it. Kyle had done it like 5 years before. So even less concrete was poured.
Yep.
And Kyle gave me kind of I wanted to get on the phone and get a turn-by-turner. And he's like, I'm not like that. Like, here's some general idea, which was great. So I had to find it on my own. So I really thought a few of my crazy friends, like, I didn't know Allison at the time, but like the Allisons of the world will show up and run this with me.
Sure.
And now it's become this whole thing. And like, I don't think I'm like, ooh, I'm a genius. I just thought it'd be fun. And people also think it's fun.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But I mean, it's one of those things that's like, it's so obvious, but someone has to take the initiative.
Right.
I'm glad you did, man.
So another thing we have in common. So you like, your name's Weisbram. I figured you were one of the chosen people, sure. As I am.
Yeah, really? I didn't know that.
So I grew up in Marietta. I went to a congregation, Etz Chaim, on whatever that is. Yeah, is that Roswell Road?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
So...
were you conservative?
So they were conservative, yeah. but I feel like leaning reform, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, leaning,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah.
So somewhere, but that is technically a conservative temple, I guess.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like all Hebrew, you know what I mean? It was definitely a mix.
Yeah. Yeah. Somewhere on the spectrum between reform and
right.
conservative.
So speaking of which, my daughter would just bat mitzvahed.
Really? And congratulations. Mazel tov.
And she went to this, I forget the name of it. It's actually in town. And she went to this place and I knew that she was working on this, like, what do you call it? What do you call it when you do stuff in the neighborhood? Community service project.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I knew I had heard about it. And like, I was taking her to school on Saturdays and Sunday, whatever it was. And then the big day comes and it's her and these other, you know, guys and girls, and like some are like, you know, some are the super Jew kids and some are like more like her. And like, I know she's doing this as part of it. It turns out it's the whole thing. No Haftorah portion, no, right?
Right.
And I was like kind of judging it at first because I'm like old school, you know what right. I mean? Like, are you even a Jew? Right. And I talked to the woman who started it, and it's like a thing started in Jerusalem, brought here. That's like, it's not about memorizing shit. It's about the Jewish experience.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, right? I mean,
and some of the kids, the super Jews, did both. They yep. do this and they do the old school one.
Interesting.
So yeah, so I like when it was like I kept waiting for it and it was over and it was like congratulations and I was like, did she do? It's kind of like going to a wedding and they don't exchange rings or kiss the bride.
Sure.
So again, and this is me, like I'm clearly not a super conservative Jew, but I was yeah. like, huh, interesting. So anyway, it's out there for those of you that, you know.
That's interesting, man. I mean, that's really cool. We had to share our bar mitzvahs with, because there were so many kids at the temple, like there wasn't enough weekends in the year to like every kid that was becoming of age, you know, to have their own weekend. So like, you know, I had to share it with this dude and like I was really into hippie, like I wanted the party to be hippie themed, you know, lava lamps and black light posters and stuff. And he wanted it to be Duke basketball themed.
Oh my God.
And so like we had this like reception where it was like down the middle of the room, like one side was like all like Duke basketball and then like one side was all like Grateful Dead posters and stuff like that.
Dude, that's like an episode of Freaks and Geeks or something. That's
really
amazing.
Is. Yeah, yeah.
So talk
good
to
show.
So I've never met a guy named Witt.
Yeah.
So can we talk about the history of your name?
Yeah, it's my grandma's maiden name.
Okay.
Which I think is kind of a Jewish tradition.
Well, Witt would be the...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so it's W-I-T-T.
Like Katerina Witt?
Yeah. And I do meet... I mean, I've met... You know, there was a few other Witts growing up in Atlanta, but they were all like W-H-I-T, short for Whitmire, Whittington.
Rednecks, probably.
Yeah.
Witt? Witt, get on over here. We're fixing to get ready. We're going to go down to the Piggly Wiggly. Yeah. Right?
Kind of. I got called Wick a lot by rednecks. You know what I mean? It's just like, don't, you know, my first name is Samuel. And so like, usually when I'm like getting like to-go food or something, they're like, what's the name? I'm like, Sam, you know, because right. It's like, you say Wit, they're like, what? You know, you go into this whole like Three Stooges like routine where it's just like, what? Wit.
Samuel, what? Young no. Samuel. I love it, man. That's so now I didn't even know that, I assume, but it's cool,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's always weird to grow up with a weird name, but then you get older and you're like, oh, I appreciate having like a weird name. Like,
so did you, when you toured, did you open for anybody famous or almost famous?
I mean, famous within the context of like our punk world, you know what I mean? So I, you know, so I had started Wonder Root, and we had the music venue in the basement, and we were playing, you know, I was booking all of the shows. So I was booking like all of these bands that were coming to Atlanta. And at the time I had gone away to college in New England, and in every city up there, there's all these like sort of like community art centers, like that have like DIY ethics and music venues. And was kind of like, we didn't really have anything like that in Atlanta growing up, you know, and wouldn't it be cool? So as soon as we opened, like we had bands from all over the country that were like, we love to play all ages shows. We don't want to, you know, charge $15 for a ticket. So it filled this void and we were just booked. Like, I want to say I worked probably close to 200 shows the first year we were open, you know? And so when my band started up, we had connections all over the country, and it was just this really cool network of like trading shows with places, you know? But eventually we like got big enough that we had a booking agent, and our booking agent represented a lot of the bands that I liked in like high school, like sort of the like emo punk bands, like Against Me, Saves the Day, Alkaline Trio, Brand New, the Get Up Kids, like Dashboard Confessional, like those types of bands. So we did, you know, get to tour and open up for a lot of the bands that I grew up idolizing, which was really cool. Except that you realize that like these guys are like at the time probably in their late 30s. The people coming to see them are coming for like nostalgia. They don't care who the opening act is. Like,
right.
You know, no one's really like paying attention to us. And it was just, you know, it also, it's one of those weird things where you know, you play in a band and you kind of follow this model of like, what do you do next to like build this institution? It's like, oh, we need a booking agent. Oh, we need a manager. Oh, we need a bigger record label, you know, but as you follow that model, at least for us, you know, the being like a DIY band, it lost a lot of the fun, you know, it lost a lot of the energy that we originally had. So that was kind of the end of it. You know, it fizzled out just because it was like, this isn't, you know, you get somewhere that you think you want to be like your whole life. Like, you know, I want to be a rock star, you know, and you get there and you kind of start looking around and you're like, I don't actually want to do this, man. This is like kind of sad. Like, you know, like you realize what level you would actually have to get to and what compromises it would take to get to that level to be like a professional musician that makes a lot of money.
Right.
And it's like, nah, not for me.
So I lived in LA, I told you, for a long time. So yeah. I did stand up.
Oh, cool.
And my dream, right, is all I wanted to be, all I cared about, like, would be to be a touring comic and get my own show, like a sitcom.
It's a rough life.
Well, I see people now, right, and yeah. like their Instagram post
yeah.
and like their headlining like Sioux Falls, and I'm yeah. like, that would suck.
Yeah.
No offense, comics who are out there living the world, but like, if I'm honest with myself, could I have been a better comic? Sure. Was I ever going to be, you know, Chris Rock? Probably not.
Yeah.
So that would be my life.
Yep.
And I would be very unhappy, and I certainly would be away from my family all the time.
All the time.
You know what I mean? So it's not a sour grapes thing. It's just knowing how good I was. Like, could I have gotten some break and gotten on some TV show, and to what end?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I... that would suck.
Yeah. But you probably understand from that experience the same way I came out of my music experience that like the best stuff is not the most popular stuff. And it's never been that way. You know what I mean? The people that win the Grammy Award,
right?
That doesn't mean they actually made the best album of the year,
right?
You know, it just means that it's commercial and
right.
Like, well, whatever. Like, well, they're playing that game, like,
right? And the thing I'm grateful for is that I did it, right? Yep. That I spent 10 years of my life,
yep.
like going for it. And again, like I look back now at all the mistakes and how I was an idiot and like didn't know how to play the game at all, and yep. like just basically like. Sitting around with your buddies going, why did that guy get a TV show? Instead of just working harder and writing more and all the things you do to become successful.
Right.
Right. And like, so I can say that to my kids, right? Like, yeah, man, fucking go for it.
Yep.
Like if one of them wants to pack up and go to LA, I'll be like, yeah, man, do it.
Yeah.
And like, I saw the country, right? In ways I would have never seen it. Right. Got laid a lot. Right. That should be part of your 20s. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's your thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, I'm so glad I did it. I have zero regrets about it. And I'm glad I'm not hustling that at 49 to try to make a buck.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of what you have to do if you don't break through.
Yeah. You know, and I feel the exact same way. Like it's an experience and getting to experience the country in that way. The people I met, the lifelong friends. Some of which did become very successful and are still out there like crushing it. And I'm so proud of them. And, you know, but yeah, I mean, I feel the exact same way. I would never trade those years for anything. But you know, it was just, it wasn't fulfilling me like in a creative, or like, you know, when it came to the actual craft of like writing and playing music, it had become more about, like the business and like trying to make it work. You know, which wasn't fulfilling.
Right.
You know,
like you probably have a lot of stories like me where like there's car rides you went on, right? Mm-hmm. That you like, you'll never forget.
Oh yeah, man.
You know, an 8-hour ride from Boston to the top of fucking Maine.
Yeah.
Right. Like I'll never forget that. I don't even really like that guy, but like mm-hmm. we traveled it together. And if I saw him today, we'd laugh about it.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Man. Totally. Yeah.
Yep. So we gotta talk about this Wonderoot thing.
Okay.
For as much as you want to. So just so you know, I had no idea before we talked. I yep. know you as Witwise Bram, guy who ran my race and then is now doing fucking Cocodona and 160 milers and all the rest of it.
Yep.
We're definitely gonna talk about Cocodona. We're definitely gonna talk about Across the Years.
Okay.
I have some avid listeners who certainly want to know about those things.
Sure.
And I want to know about those things. But I knew about Wonderoot through the Atlanta Fringe Festival. I don't know if you come across that at all.
No, I don't remember that one.
Okay, so they're still happening. I think they went virtual a couple years, but a couple of local improv and sketch people were like, Atlanta doesn't have a Fringe Festival. Let's start one. And that was one of the venues. And so I was cool. Like, oh, this place is cool.
Yeah.
And now that I've passed it, I used to drive by it all the time because I actually lived over in Kirkwood, but it's just like, I know it as a thing in Atlanta. Yeah. And then you're like, oh, I started that place. And I was like, oh, cool. So anyway, so now we need to talk about that.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I went to school in New England and.
So real quickly, where in New England?
Hampshire College.
Which is what town?
Amherst, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
And it's, you know, it's like a weird liberal arts school, no right. grades or tests.
Right. So I did gigs like all over there, Western Mass,
really?
New England. When I did,
what, like over in like Northampton and stuff?
Name a crappy town somewhere in New England.
Yeah.
And I did stand up there. Yeah. Probably the same way you did a lot of like,
yeah.
you know, you show up and you got to tell them to turn the TVs off.
Oh, yeah, man. Because before the band, I was a solo acoustic guy, which is the worst life. I mean, because you're like, you know, the best gig you get is like you're the feature at the open mic night.
Right.
And it literally is like there's TVs, you know, it's like no one gives a fuck. But yeah, I mean, you know, it was just seeing things at a time in my life where I was super inspired and like absorbing everything, you know, my late teens, early 20s. And, you know, the idea was like, man, wouldn't it be cool if there was something like this, like a community arts center in Atlanta? And so because my school was so weird, like you basically instead, you know, when you, the whole last year you're there, it's like an applied project. And so my last year was spent, writing the, you know, 150 page business plan for Wonderoot, starting to get the business structure put in place, getting donations, starting a 501c3, like nonprofit, you know, and that's what I was studying in school. So I came back to Atlanta. We leased the place over on Memorial, at the time was cheap, you know? And yeah, I mean, it was a beautiful time in my life. And honestly, probably the time I felt most connected to Atlanta, like in the sense of just being a part of like the art community and the music community, and, you know, felt like we were bringing something that was needed. You know, back then in Atlanta, if you were a good musician or a good artist, like it made a lot more sense to leave Atlanta. It was like, it's like, I'm going to go to New York. I'm going to go to LA, you know? And we were like, maybe if there's something actually here to support artists, like people might stick around. Like,
so what year is this?
It's probably 2006 or seven.
Right.
That we're conceptualizing, we're like building it. And then we opened up and it was immediately, you know, successful.
So was it you opened it with 100% donations?
Yeah. All like grassroots style. Like we were kind of like taking, you know, small donations from the community. And the original model was that people had memberships. Like it was like cheap. It was like $40 a year to use, you know, we had a recording studio, a dark room, a digital lab, you know. And that was kind of the idea, was like, let's keep this as like a grassroots, you know, community-based effort. And so I had started it with a really good friend of mine at the time, who was my best friend. And, you know, we were like living together, running Wonder Root. We were kind of just like on that grind. Over the next couple of years, you know, I think because we were successful so quickly, we were kind of like, well, where do we go next? And we really had different ideas about that.
What was yours?
My idea was like, we're doing exactly what we set out to do. Like, let's actually like turn the lens internal and like operate this thing and build this thing in a way that's like radical and creative. So I was, you know, at that point I had gone to grad school to even learn more about like nonprofits and running nonprofits. And like, you know, I think we were aware when we opened Wonder Root, like in what was going on in Reynoldstown in East Atlanta, that like this could be something that's like really valuable to the community, or this could be something that like changes the whole neighborhood and gentrifies it. You know what I mean? And so there was always that fine line.
Right.
And I was more interested in like progressive, like let's open up our board of directors to our members. Like let's have the community be involved in like the decision-making and like where this goes. Like let's basically turn it over to the community as like a resource. My business partner had sort of become like a lot of people do in the nonprofit world, had become like sort of like taken in by the like galas and like wearing suits and like, you know, and bigger money started coming in.
From it's like, Duke versus Grateful Dead all over again.
Yeah, basically. And so I just got to a point where I was like really fed up and discontent, and was like, I don't want to be an executive director anymore. I just want to run the like venue in the basement. I'll forgo my salary. But it didn't go that clean. He was basically just like, all your stuff's in a box outside.
Oh man, that's a bummer.
Like, you know, and this had been the dream for years that I'd worked hard on. And so, you know, over the, you know, next 10, 15 years, I watched it continue and thrive, and it wasn't exactly what I had wanted it to be, but like, I was grateful that it was still there and that it was still, an asset to the community and that artists were still able to utilize it and stuff. But I guess it was like a couple years ago that, you know, a lot of the stuff that worried me about my business partner
came to light.
And I really wish that the people that were affected by him hadn't been. You know what I mean? Like, no one should have to deal with that kind of like emotional abuse and stuff. You know,
Is it done now?
Yeah.
Because so. I remember those stories. The stories were just like abusive behavior, right? Like not a good boss,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Like it wasn't the sexual kind. It was just the shitty kind.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know what happened.
Well, I'm saying usually like,
I haven't spoken to that guy literally since the day he put my stuff in a box outside of Wonder.
I'm just saying like to distinguish, because that's usually one of the reasons people go down these days is like because people aren't going to tolerate. I think
there were accusations of that nature, which I wouldn't be surprised.
Right.
There was an internal investigation that cleared him of that.
Right. Which so we, I, right. Know. We always trust internal investigators. Right. Hey, turns out we're okay.
Yeah, so that's why, right. That's why I say, I don't know, but so, like, I, you know, I'm sure there was some.
So I can't remember. I remember reading about it in either AJC or Creative Loafing or whatever. So did they oust him or did he quit? Like, now I don't remember what happened.
I think that, they cleared him. He quit on his own. And then the board decided that they could not continue on without him. Which kind of goes back to like the stuff I was trying to implement early on, which is like, this place should not be so dependent on us as the directors that it couldn't function without.
Dude, you could have Steve Jobbed it, man. They could have brought you back in. The ousted visionary comes back.
Yeah, you know, I was also more interested in like touring the country with my punk band. So, but yeah, I mean, it was a my mom worked for the High Museum my whole life, you know, so I got to like basically grow up at the High Museum, you know, and so like art has always been like something really important to me, and it was something I'll always be proud of, you know, Wonder Root. And I still meet people, younger kids who like went to their first concert ever, like, you know, their parents like dropped them off, or their dad stood in the back of the room while they watched like their favorite, you know, DIY punk band play. And like that kind of stuff was super important to me when I was that age. So like, I'm really grateful that I was able to provide that experience for a lot of people. It was, you know, it seems like that was an era of Atlanta. Like now you have other places filling that same need, the bakery, like stuff like that. It's interesting because like, I'm really proud of it and what we did. At the same time, like it's, I feel sort of guarded, you know, at this point, being like, I was a founder of Wonder Root because of like the connotations of what happened, you know? And I also usually have to clarify, I wasn't that founder.
So what do you think the personal lessons for you are?
Dude, honestly, like a lot of the things that I've carried into running now, you know, and it's, you know, a lot of it has to do with this like thing that I'm trying to understand about like us as creative people or humans or artists or whatever, that like we feel this need to build institutions around the things that we enjoy doing or like doing, you know, and part of that was the music experience as well. It's like, you know, we have something that we're passionate about and we love doing. And for some reason, there's this like drive to like make it into more, to like commodify it, to build, you know, something around it. And I look around in like the through hiking world and the running world, and it, you know, it honestly scares me a little bit to see the like influencer stuff like becoming more and more of like the goal of like outdoor athletes. You know what I mean? Because in my mind, it's like, I've seen this before in other contexts and it doesn't end well for the sport or like for the craft. You know what I mean? So, just sort of like, I guess like questioning, like, you know, it's like, especially when we have things that we want to do to help other people, this day and age, it's like the first thing is like, oh, I need to start a nonprofit to do that. You know what I mean? But there's so many other creative ways to like do stuff. You know, I like, that's one reason like I appreciate the race that you don't organize, you know, because it's like people get out and have fun and like do their thing that they love to do, but it's not, you know, it's not really, it doesn't have that vibe of like the corporate race stuff or whatever, you know?
So I feel like this is like, I'm really enjoying talking to you because I feel like we're super similar. So like where you're sitting, right? Like this is not a guy with a business plan.
Yeah.
This is not a guy. I've never had a business plan or a degree or a big check from anybody.
Yeah.
And fortunately and unfortunately for me, I don't know how to do it any other way. Mm-hmm. It would be good if I found a partner who is, and I never have. I've always kind of partnered with guys more like me, which I don't need, right? Just kind of type A, let's go fucking do this, let's knock the wall down, I don't know how we're going to do it, we'll figure it out later. Which usually, if you've got the grounded person, right, if you've got the Wozniak or the person that's going to like tell you what you can afford and not afford, you both can have a good effect on each other, right? Yeah. They're going to help you be more buttoned down and do things right. You're going to help them step out, and I've never had that. So I've only done it this way, right? But it's come from exactly what you've said. Okay. I thought, in 2012, I thought it would be fun to talk to these people in this little world of obstacle racing that I was doing. I thought this seems like a fun idea. I like This American Life. I like Marc Maron.
Nice. Yeah.
And maybe I could just talk to people. And then it's become my whole business, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then 5 or 6 years after that, I was like, well, I like talking to people. Why don't I talk to people in Atlanta? So like, this is my creative juices, right?
Yeah.
And that's the only way I know how to do it, right?
Yeah.
Now, I probably could learn a thing or two.
Sure.
And be more buttoned down.
Yeah.
And make slightly more money.
Right.
Right. But like I said to you, like me and my friend said, let's run around the whole city and see, right? And we all know that it's coming. We all know that the fucking Atlanta Track Club version of my race is coming, and that's fine.
Yeah.
Like the minute that thing
it's
is
paved, it's done. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The minute it's all the way connected, that race is coming. And in some ways, it'll be like my race will be even cooler. Right.
Right.
Right. And would I like to make more money by more people doing it? Sure. But at the end of the day, I spend a little money on Facebook ads and the people that come and it's a good time.
Yeah. But you're not, I mean, you know, like it's, you know, it's, as much as I love running like these big 200 mile races and stuff, I mean, these are like major events, you know, these are like, you know, and the cost to even do them is like insane, you know? And it's not that like, they're not putting, you know, a lot of that money goes into being able to produce an event like that. I mean, you get to like the Moab 240. I mean, there's 5 or 6 tractor trailer trucks, like some of them refrigerated trucks, because you're provide, you know, and then you've got to get those supplies out to these like aid stations, you know. I mean, it does cost a lot to produce, but like there's something really, to me at least, beautiful about less produced, you know, it's the lo-fi races, you know. And so that's, I love running those races, because you get to compete with, you know, some of the best runners out there. But at the same time, like I'm feeling more and more inclined towards these like weird, you know, and that's one of the beautiful things about ultra running is like, there's a lot of like underground weird stuff going on, you know, and I'm way more interested in that.
Well, I'm wondering how much of you is competitive, because, you know, this ultra running, like all races, they say, don't worry about the competition, just do what you do, blah, 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 right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's a downhill skiing event or a race or whatever, right? And certainly when you go up to the 240-mile multiple-day thing, you know, across the years, whatever, like, again, like, it's like you can't even quantify how much that's about you and not about anybody else.
Yeah.
But is it important for you to finish near the top?
I think the only reason it feels important for me to finish towards the top is because like the level that I'm at now, like it is the, it's not about beating the person that's in front of me, but it's like, I know that I can push that hard and compete at that level. So like, it still is a self-competitive drive. You know what I mean? Like I look at the times of people like winning these races and I'm like, I think I can do that, you know? So it's still more about competing with myself and like what I can do. And it's a beautiful thing that people are throwing down these times, because it gives you something to push towards, you know? And that's, you know, the way I got into racing to begin with was, you know, I'd started off doing like the FKT stuff, like just alone, like out on long trails, you know, before I had run any of those races, I had become the fastest person to ever cross the state of Arizona on foot, you know, self-supported.
Nice.
You know, and stuff like that. And those are the things I still like love to do. It's just, it takes a little more like time and effort.
Are you aware of my one and only FKT? The only one I'll probably ever get.
No.
So I did the Silver Comet self-supported.
Did you really?
Yeah.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
You know, but that vibe, like, so you understand, like it's a different vibe than like lining up at a race.
Dude, I was fucking miserable because I misjudged where the food was.
Right.
And I ended up like walking across a highway and going to a Wendy's. And that's the best part of it, looking back. Yeah. Of course it was.
Right.
You know, I mean, I even said, so I recorded a lot of it. And, you know, I like said, like at the moment, like I wanted an adventure and I got an adventure.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm so proud of that.
Yeah.
And I know that it's like could be beaten pretty easily.
Yeah. But that's not the point.
Right.
You know,
I'm just so happy I did it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like, it's cool because with FKTs, it's like you always were the, you know, it's like even if someone's broken it, it's like you held that for a moment, you know, and it's like, But the point is that like that was the mindset that I came into this with, where I was like thankful that like one of my heroes, like someone like Heather Anderson, like her trail name's Anish, like, you know, was breaking these long trail records on like the Appalachian Trail and the Pacific Crest Trail and the Arizona Trail, which is who I took her record when I beat it, you know. And it was like, more than feeling like competitive with her, I felt grateful that she had set this bar. And when you're out there alone, it's the number that you're competing with, not the other person.
Right. It's like a kinship you now have.
Exactly.
The guys that did it before me did it supported. Like they had guys meet them and they did the, and I wrote them right when I was doing it and we all exchanged the messages. And then like when I beat it, they were thrilled for me.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, when I did it by myself, they were thrilled for me. So it's what we call an OKT, and only, I'm the only one who's even done it. Right. So what were the first ones you got?
I had only run like a few races. I had run, this race out at Conyers Horse Park was the first ultra. I'd never run more than 10 miles. You know, so just a little bit about my background. I mean, I had hiked the whole Appalachian Trail when I was in 2003, when I was 19, graduated high school.
And what did they call you out there?
I didn't have a trail name then, but my trail name now is El Matador.
I love it.
So I hiked the AT, which is like a life-changing experience, but you don't really know that when you're 19.
Right, because you haven't lived a lot of life.
You haven't lived a lot of life.
Right.
So I hiked the trail, go to college, start Wonderoot, play in the band, like, you know, have like long-term relationships, like kind of living a more normal life. And when I turned in my early 30s, you know, it was just, something didn't feel right. I wasn't happy with where I was. And I thought to myself, oh, you know, a through hike, like that's, it seems like a big sacrifice, you know, 4 or 5 months, but to reset your mental health, your physical health, you know, all of these things, is it really that big of a sacrifice? And so I went out to hike the Pacific Crest Trail, just was like, this is what I love. Like, I don't know why I've been away from this for so long. Finished that, hiked the Continental Divide Trail, Arizona Trails, had come back to Atlanta in 2017 after the Continental Divide Trail, was just going out to Sweetwater Creek State Park, you know, just to hike every day. Cause I was like, man, I need to be outside. And then slowly was like, this isn't really scratching the itch of hiking 25 miles a day, day after day, that I was used to. So I started running the trails.
So you just do like 5 loops at Sweetwater. That would be your day.
I would just run the, you know, a couple of the, you know, I'd run the white loop or something.
Right.
And I was like, wow, I like this running. So right. I signed up for this, the Austin Taylor Challenge. My friend Kevin was throwing out at Conyers. It was a 50K, got second. I was like, this is cool. Met Andrew Catanese. He was like the first runner I ever ran with because he was a painter. You know, he's like a weirdo like me. And it was like, oh, like we're not jocks. Like we're just people that like doing this.
So
talk about art while we run, not like
right. So I actually know the Austin Taylor because
really?
A friend of mine did it. My friend Wes did it.
Yeah,
and it's probably the most bare bones ultra like there is. Like Conyers Horse Park is like a 1 on a scale of 1 to 10 for technical.
Sure.
And you know, I've done a lot of obstacle races there, but they just kind of, you know, it's in honor of a kid and it's a whole thing, but like, it's pretty simple.
Yeah.
So I just think it's kind of cool. That that's your start. Like, hey, let's like 3 loops of this course
and
or whatever.
It was literally like, I know I can walk this mileage in the time limit if I have to.
Right.
And then I met Andrew and he was amazing runner, dude. Like, you know, he ran through college, you know, and we had this really cool experience for a year or two where it was like, you know, sort of introducing him to the trails. Like, you know, that was my specialty, like, and he was teaching me how to run, you know? And, so we signed up for the Lake Martin 50 miler, in Alabama and we got first and second. We ran the whole thing together and won the race. And then, you know, just kept progressing. Then I think yours was the next one after that.
Wow.
And just little ways to keep pushing, you know, it's like, let's do 2 loops at run the ATL.
Right.
Let's,
and I have to say many, and I know I told you this, but from the first time I did it, people were like, oh, I'm going to turn it into an ultra. I'm going to do 2 loops. And everybody runs 1 loop in that July heat and goes, fuck this.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Yeah.
And you guys went and did the second loop.
Yeah.
And
well, funny story about the second loop. I don't know if you knew this, but like, you know, I can't beat Andrew. Like, Andrew's on a different level. But we're coming around the east side belt line on that second loop, and it was hot, dude, like brutally hot. And we get to the King of Pops.
Right.
And we're like, you know, we should get some popsicles. Andrew sits down. He's like, I'm done. And I'm like, what are you talking about, dude? Like, we're almost there. We're going to be the first people to ever,
right,
like, do this. And he's like, I'm calling, you know, it's over. I'm going to get picked up. And so I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to keep moving, man, because I'm like seizing up, you know?
And because at that point, you're 30 miles into a very, very hot day.
No salt left in my body.
Right.
Just like brutalized. And I start moving. And at that time, you know, a lot of that was unfinished as you're coming around.
All the kudzu.
The kudzu, the bridge, you know, the kudzu bridge and stuff. I mean, and I'm starting to think in my mind, like, I'm going to be the first one.
Nice.
You know, like, I was like, I can't believe I'm going to beat Andrew at this. And I'm like, and all of a sudden I hear this pitter-patter coming behind me.
Right.
And I'm like, God. And Andrew just like blows by me.
Right.
And he's just like, he just turns around. He's just like, dude, I'm going to finish it, but I just can't go as slow as you're going.
Wow.
And I was like, no. But yeah, I mean, so that, you know, we finished that one. And like I said, you know, I had been in a relationship for a decade with someone who played in the band with me. We toured together.
Oh boy.
That's how we fell in love.
A little Fleetwood Mac situation.
You know, we had an art gallery over here on Charles Allen right off of Ponce. You know, that was falling apart. And so I left Atlanta. I moved into a van. I went up
down by the river.
I went up to Maine by the ocean, and I'm sitting there and I'm like, I want to run 100 miler. There's no races to sign up for. So I looked at a section of the Appalachian Trail, a very famous section called the 100-Mile Wilderness, the last part of the Appalachian Trail. And I'd never really heard of FKTs. I looked it up. I was like, I think I could beat that time, unsupported.
What year was this?
2018.
Okay.
And I just went out there. I had no idea what I was doing. And I was like, you know, it's a really remote area. I was like, there's no bailing once I start. And just pushed through it, was in tears, hallucinating, you know, sort of my initiation into that distance, and came out an hour ahead of the previous FKT, you know, and then immediately a month later went to Arizona and broke the self-supported FKT of the 800-mile Arizona Trail.
Did people like me start reaching out to you then?
No.
You still weren't on anybody's radar?
No. Never have been, man. I mean, this is like the first podcast.
People know, really?
Yeah.
Well, people at least know who you are. I mean, so my friend Hannah, Hannah Carta.
Yeah.
I think she was out. No, she did 6 days in the dome. Maybe she did across the years too. I can't remember. But like, she was all excited when I told her
that's cool.
You were coming on.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, part of it is like what we were talking about before. It's like, I don't really want to play that game. And it's because I've learned from my other experiences, like, you know, I want to do this as my craft, as like my art, you know,
right.
And it does fill that same itch that I was filling writing music. Like, it feels like a creative process to me that I'm like still pushing the limits of, and I don't want it to become my like a profession.
But what if I told you that by doing something like this, you might inspire someone who's never run that far to try something?
Well, that's the kind of stuff I'm interested in. You know what I mean? But like, I'm not playing the Instagram game. I'm not, you know, I have been reached out to by like running companies that are like, we'll send you a water bottle. We want you to like post 5 times. And I'm like, that's not worth selling out for.
Certainly not.
Sorry. You know what I mean? Like, because I know a lot.
Would you take a pair of shoes from Hoka?
No, because I don't wear Hokas.
What do you wear?
Ultras.
Okay. Would you take a pair of shoes from Ultra for 5 posts?
One pair? No.
Okay. What about travel stipend? You know what I mean? Like few more bennies.
I would do it for like race entry fees, gear, like, you know, like I would, you know, if it was like a
race entry fees plus free gear.
Plus gear, like, you know what I mean? Yeah, I'd probably be more interested in it.
Okay.
But you know as well as I do that you know, you have to be pretty big time to get that kind of stuff.
Right. I just, again, I'm super interested because you've been down that road, and because like you've been a musician. Like, when we're really young, we have this idea that all selling out is bad.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, you must be a piece of shit. Right.
Yeah,
like, I mean, like in the,
well, those of us that were into punk, yes.
Dude, so there was a Ramones commercial for like Bud or Bud Light or something. I lost my mind.
Yeah.
I was like, what's going on?
Yeah.
Right. So, but that's why I'm kind of asking, like, so there is something that's worth it. Right. Because if it's a product you like anyway, right. Definitely don't do it for the stupid.
No.
I mean, those people don't even, that doesn't even count to me. That to me is like the same as like, you know, you've got $1 million if you write the person in Germany or in Botswana, you know what I'm saying? Like that's the same level of crap that is. So I wouldn't expect you to take one of those.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that like, that there aren't like athletes, like I'm very, very privileged that I can like set my life up to pursue this stuff, financially with the support of my family, with friends, because there are a lot of people that, you know, are like marginalized from these sports because of the entrance fees, like because of the like insane amount of like food that I have to put in my body to train. Like, you know, you look around the world, like people are struggling to like eat a few grains of rice for the most part, you know?
Right.
And so I understand when an exceptional athlete needs the support of a company or like a sponsor, like I'm not saying it's all bad, like to your point.
Right.
But you know, it does seem like these companies tend to reward the same types of people like over and over again that are willing to like,
right. But that's never going to change though.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's always going to be, you know, the art versus commerce conversation.
Sure.
In sports, in whatever. And so like people hate on like Dean Karnazes, for example. Right. Right.
Yeah.
And is Dean like a horrible person? Like, not really.
No.
He's a guy that found this certain niche. And so he gets to be the person that most people associate with 100 milers, even though the real air quotes 100 milers could give a fuck about Dean Karnazes. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But like, you know what I mean? And so the whole idea of, it used to be, I mean, it's gotten worse in some ways that like we went from actually having a skill to, well, maybe I can just line up and get on American Idol and or be on a reality show with zero skills.
Right.
Like that was already the bottom. And now it's just like fire up an Instagram account and pretend to be rich or pretend to be wonderful.
Yeah.
But people still appreciate the real artist, whether it's a musician or an athlete or a trail runner.
Yeah.
Like, we're always going to have both.
And what's cool is like there's enough room in these sports for the spectrum of experience and vibes and, you know, but I would like to stay on that end of it. You know what I mean? Like, there's just so much, man, you know, it's like I had a message from like a Nike guy after across the years, being like, you know, we want to do more trail stuff, you know? And I think Nike's attempted it a couple times, like had little trail teams,
right?
But they're definitely not like a big piece of the market share with like trail runners and stuff. You know, same way they went with skateboarding where it's just like they tried to break in for a while and finally did. But it's like, man, you know, and it was basically like, we'd love to send you some trail gear to get your feedback or whatever. It's like, dude, it's Nike. I mean, it's like what, you know, I'm aware of like what you're doing to your women runners. Like I'm aware of like all of that stuff. And it's like, how could I possibly, you know, take this product from you and like tell people that it, you know, to buy it and stuff. Like, you know, I can't do it, man.
I get it, man.
You know, but yeah, so I don't know, like a lot of it did come from that through hiking mentality, you know, like that, you know, that's, I think that's why the distances don't scare me. Like I've normalized like distances, long distances, like, you know, 2000 plus, you know, mile trails. Like, so when it's like this concept of like running 100 miles or running 200 miles, like the distance doesn't like scare me anymore. I mean, I do, the more I do them, there is this reality of what it takes out of you physically.
Well,
and it's like, the thing that scares me is like the reality of like how I'm, you know, knowing that it's going to be a month or two of like recovery and like, pain.
So I've gone 24 hours plus a couple times. And that's more than most people, you know, whatever percentage of the world will ever do. But this idea of multiple day to me is like, that blows my mind the same way a 100 miler blows a 5K-er's mind, because it's exponential.
Yeah.
The mental pain, the physical pain, it's not just like 2 days is twice as harder as 1 day. 2 days is 10 times hard as 1 day. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the other thing that had become normalized to me from through hiking was like, you have to get up the next day and do it again over and over and over without a shower. Your shoes might be soaking wet.
Right.
So, you know, this acceptance of like the discomfort was something that I, you know, had experienced and like feel like I thrive in it. Like I love being like, you know, I was listening to some like Dylan tune when I was running it across the years, you know, and the Ballad of Hattie Carroll, I think, like, but he, you know, he's just like doomed and determined, you know, and that's how I like, that's like where I thrive, like feeling like I'm doomed, but also like determined to keep going, you know, dirty, like soaked, you know, like toenails falling off, like for some reason in my weird life, that's when I come alive and like perform, you know?
See, this is a fascinating concept to me that I think is like you might be born with, right? Doesn't take away from who you are, but there are people who do. So I have a friend, Amelia Boone, right? Who runs obstacle races and who loves, she's like you, like the harder it is, all about it, right? Yeah. Like I think she's going to try Barkley again, right?
Yeah, that's hardcore.
Yeah. And there, I feel like some people might be born with a slightly different thing. And again, not that it's easier for you, but that you just, you're able to go to a different place. And it's this whole idea of like nature versus nurture and medicine versus science versus, because not a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah. But I agree, but I also do think, and to kind of like bring it back to like across the years and the thing that's really drawn me towards these long loop races, is that it does seem like anyone can do it. That's the other thing, right? It almost seems like it is part of our human potential that we've lost, you know, through modern, you know, whatever it is that we tell ourselves we can't do for whatever reasons. Because like what's so inspiring, like something across the years is like you're watching like a 75-year-old woman do 500 miles.
Right.
Everything that, you know, says like this can't happen or this shouldn't happen at that point in life. An 86-year-old man doing a couple hundred miles and like, you know, I mean, it's...
So I did another race that Laz did. This is called Race for the Ages.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you do it based on your handicap based on your age or something like that.
Right.
Or,
so I did that and that was a life changer for me because I'm out there. I have a blog about it, which I would link if I remember, but I won't. And anytime I was... I might cry. Anytime I was ready to quit or think about it, I passed this 86-year-old guy. Who's going?
I'm tearing up just because I know what it's like.
As slow as a human can go, but still going.
Still going.
And so the next year, he went out to do that race and he died, like at some point during the race.
Yeah.
And that happened a few times. Yeah. And Laz has a lot of opinions about that. And what he said about it is like people aren't coming here to die. It's just kind of how it's gone.
Yep.
So Dan is his name, Dan Baglione. When it's 2 a.m. or 4 a.m. and an 86-year-old is, he's, like I said, moving at a pace you can't even understand. And it's like, fuck.
I mean, that brings me back to the best memories of across the years, man, like crawling out of my van at, you know, to get some more laps done at 2 a.m. The course is pretty dead, usually midnight to 5 a.m. And it's like, I look down the straightaway, you know, and these old guys, they get the lean and you're, it's like a ghost. It's like but this person is still going.
Right.
Slow.
You don't usually say anything to each other. You don't even usually make eye contact.
You don't, you know, I mean, it became apparent to me that they don't want to hear from me.
Were you trying to be encouraging?
Well, yeah, but like, you know, it's like they're in a zone, man. Which is, you know, what I'm realizing is the guys that are winning the races too, like, This is a metaphysical, spiritual sport, you know, where these guys are able to ride these like trances for days and days and days. But like, you know, yeah, I mean, it was limitlessly inspiring to be on that loop with the elders of our sport. To me, the legends, like this guy Dan you're talking about, man, like that's a legend. Like, I mean, I'm impressed by like Jim Walmsley and guys that can run fast for 100 miles, but like, the legends to me are these elders that are like walking slowly, consistently, you know, like transcending like everything we think about sport or what it means to be an athlete. and what a beautiful thing, like, to be on a loop where it's like this intergenerational experience. You know, it's something like Cocodona, like, you're off, you aren't going to see those people again. Whereas like on a loop like that, like, you know, there's a lot to learn by just watching or by observing, you know.
Do you know who Ray Kay is?
Dude, Ray Kay is my boy. You know Ray Kay?
So I got to walk with Ray Kay.
Yeah.
At that race. We're born in the same hospital, Brockton, Massachusetts.
Really?
Yeah. Dude. Ray. So just that alone, right, worth the trip, because we're talking about where we're from.
Yeah.
And then I didn't get a lot of time with him either. I just stopped or he stopped, but he just said something like, because I just, you know, I had to fucking ask, right? Like, you don't, like, it's like meeting Tom Brady and it's like, how do you throw the football? And so I just had to ask him something, and he just said something like why he keeps doing it. And he just said something like, you know, I can just observe something like, you know, I'm walking this way and this guy's walking this way. And it's just like, it was deep in the moment.
Yeah.
And like, since then, I like try to get him on the podcast a couple of times. He doesn't give a fuck about being on a fucking podcast.
No. And that's
he's just people. If you don't know who Ray Kay is, look him up. Ray Cook. I don't even know how to say his last
Kralowski.
Name. Just look it up. He's a fucking legend.
Ray the Kay.
And that's Ray the Kay. And that's the beauty, is that, how about Fegis?
Yeah, I mean,
okay, so Fegis, I've gotten to talk to a few times because he's from here. Fegis has done my race. And again, Fegis, I'm like, what are you going to eat during the race? He's like, I don't know, a fucking pizza.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Fuck calorie counting. Fuck anything.
Yeah.
Just, it's amazing, dude.
It's amazing. And it's like I was saying before, it fills this creative like itch in me to like see this stuff and to try and understand it, because it's so counter to like everything that I've learned traditionally about athletics, about fueling your body. Like you're saying, I mean, calorie counting, how much protein do I need? Like the guy that beat me across the years, I mean, he's like this Mongolian spiritual runner that only consumed coconut water and avocados for 10 days.
Amazing.
And it's just like, you know, there were moments where you look at him and you're like, you know, there's no protein going into this guy's body. Like there's, you know, there's no supplements, there's no noon tablets or Tailwind, like, you know, and it's fascinating to me. And I want to like continue down that path. I want to understand it. You know, I want to experience it.
So you sign up for Across the Years. Mm-hmm. You're standing on the start line.
Yeah.
Your goal is what?
It was arrogant. I just kind of had never done it before. Hadn't really looked into what people were doing. Like, I knew the course record was like 735 miles, which was set by an Australian woman who's a few years older than me. Like, that was my goal.
Like, I'm going to get the record.
Yeah. But once I started talking to some people and stuff, you know, it's like, that's pretty arrogant for a first timer.
Right.
So I kind of abandoned that and just took it day by day. Like, Bujaral, the Mongolian runner, and I were like neck and neck for, it's kind of funny to say it, 'cause it's like half the race, which was 5 days. we were basically tied starting day six. And then
at how many miles?
Close to 400.
Okay.
And I had been pushing really hard to try and stay with him, and I finally crashed on day six, you know, and he started pulling ahead. But, you know, it was, I also realized that this is like an international sport. I mean, like Joe and Ray Kay, like Bob Hearn, those guys are, the best Americans, you know, but compared to like the guys from like,
right,
know, Europe, Romania, Greece, you know, so like I started realizing that most of the runners there are thinking of things in kilometers instead of miles.
Right.
And so the 1,000 kilometer mark became like my goal at some point, because that's a big milestone if you're thinking in kilometers, right?
Right.
So that's, I hit the 1,000 kilometer, was able to put a few more loops in, and I felt really happy with that.
So 1,000 kilometers, give it for our American audience.
Yeah. 1,000 kilometers, that's about 623 miles. I ended up with 630, I think.
Right. And the winner got
690. And that wasn't even a good race for him. You know, he goes into the 800s regularly.
In a 10-day period?
Yeah.
And it's funny, that's what, so Fegis had the 3-day American record.
Yeah.
And
he still has the 6-day American.
And I said, why did you sign up for that race? He said, I wanted to see how far I could go in 3 days.
Yep.
Then he signed up for the 6-day. This is before he had his own 6-day, I think. You know, yeah, he does that 6 days in the dome.
Yeah.
And I said, well, why do you want to do that? And he goes, because I want to see how far I can run for 6 days. Like, it's just that simple for him.
Yep.
And he's just this regular fucking dude.
Yeah.
Right? Like, just this right, like we think they all have to be like some like Walmsley-esque person. And that is what's so, to me, what's so awesome about these guys. Yeah. So what, I just kind of want to know what it was like. I don't know. What are days 6 through 10 like? Cause it's, I feel like I can't even wrap my brain around it. Let me just ask you
day
this.
Day 6 was horrible, but day 7, 8, 9, 10 were better than day 2, 3, 4.
Because
your body starts adjusting to it. It's like you wake up on day 2 or 3 after putting in 180 miles or something and like you can't move. Like you're like, how am I going to continue? And you start walking and it's like rust breaking off of your legs. And eventually you can like walk in a normal stride. And then it's like, let me test out a little trot now, you know? And then it's like this miraculous thing where like all of a sudden it's like, wait, I'm running again. But by day 7, it's like you wake up and the soreness is gone. The tightness is gone. And your body's like, okay, I understand what we're doing. Fuel me properly and I will do it, you know? And also, you know, I don't do any special diets or anything, but I have noticed over the years that like when I enter ketosis, which I generally am aware of because I smell like cat piss, like I'll just be like, I'll be like, oh, I'm there, you know, that there is some, maybe neurological or something in that state that, my energy level stays more consistent and I just feel like euphoric. And so it was like the last 3 days of that race, like, you know, my body's like breaking down and like eating itself, but like I felt great, you know?
Well, that's, I guess, so death isn't so miserable.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, it's almost like, and this has been my experience at Cocodona and Moab, which like, you know, the first time I ran the Moab 240, it was just about survival. It's like, can I even do this? And then I went back the next year, went top 5, and then a few months later went top 5 at Cocodona 250, which is the longest trail race in the country. And at both of those races, there was this like little death period where like, and it was early on at those two races where like maybe mile 50 or 60, it was like a total meltdown. It was like, am I dying? Like I'm seeing double, like I'm having like auditory hallucinations. I'm way behind on hydration. Cause you're out in the desert at these things. And then it's like once I pulled out of those, it was like, it's over with. Like the death is over with. Now let's crush.
It is by dying.
And I just start climbing through the field, you know?
It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. That's what I was going to say.
It literally felt like that at those races where like, it's almost like, let's just get this out of the way.
This is actually inspiring me a lot. I've had my lowest 2 months in a long time.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I was training for, which I definitely want to ask you about, a backyard ultra last year.
Oh, nice.
Are you signing up for any?
I've never done one.
Seems like it might be your jam.
It might be. I've got some weird goals, man. So,
well, was definitely going to get to those. So, yeah. So my goal to, when I did that was like, oh, well, people are like, what's your goal? I'm like, oh, well, I want to be the last one standing. Like, is there any other goal to have?
Right.
And then, you know, I was not the last one standing and I wasn't even in the top, you know, 40.
Yeah.
But I now know how to approach that race. I feel like right. You got to do one just to do one. Right.
Yep.
And, but I was like, I distinctly remember this time of year, every day I was on the Beltline near my house. It was pissing rain. It was cold, like every day. And I was out there doing my miles. I had a coach, I had a plan. And then when it finally broke and was like in the 60s, I was like, this is the greatest. Right.
Yeah.
And this year when it's cold, I'm like, pass me the fucking, you know, cereal. Like I'm just not, yeah. I'm going through and I'm trying not to beat myself up for it. It's just like, yeah. Dude, this is the phase of life you're in right now. And at some point you'll start running again.
Yeah. So I'll just tell you briefly. I mean, I trained very differently for across the years than I normally do for a race. And I had a really bad summer. I had a bad fall, early winter.
What's bad for you though? What's a low mileage week for you?
Just like, not physically, like I was having a rough time.
Okay.
You know, like just struggling to feel confident in my path. Like, I'd gotten Lyme disease. I work on the Appalachian Trail in the summers as a ridge runner. So that keeps me in really good shape.
What's a ridge runner?
It's basically a ranger that works for the trail, not the government. So I have 60 miles of the Appalachian Trail that I traverse back and forth all summer long. with my pack.
Making sure that it's...
Making sure people... I'm a wilderness EMT. I respond to emergencies. I clean up trash. I report trail conditions, saw, blowdown. I mean, you know, just a variety of tasks. But I got Lyme disease this summer, and it really messed me up, like, neurologically. And so I was, like, coming out of that, like, kind of concerned about how is this going to affect my running? How is this going to affect endurance? Just not feeling good, man. And then, like, fall hit, and it was, like... You know, I spend like 80% of my time like alone in the woods. And it was like all this COVID stuff for the last 2 years. It was like really feeling a sense of lack of like connection to friends, you know, relationships, just worry, you know, like, I don't know, man. So like, which was affecting my running, my physical training too. Like I didn't feel motivated. But this interview came out like right towards the end of the summer, when Alexander Sorkinson broke Janos Koros's 24-hour record. Do you know about this?
Mm-mm.
You know Janos Koros is?
I feel like I should know that name.
Dude,
is he the one that battled Fijis a couple years ago?
Late in his life, yes, and Fijis beat him. But he used to run with Ray the K all the time, like when in the last golden era of like loop running, when they were running in like stadiums in Europe getting paid money.
Wow.
But he's the greatest ultra runner of all time.
Okay.
Greek guy, Janos Koros. His records still stand. And what people thought was the greatest record of all time, which was his 24-hour record, which was like 178 miles or something in 24 hours, fell this year to this guy, Alexander Sorkinson, who's breaking every record. He just broke the 100. He was the first person ever to run sub 1100 miles of like last month. I've like tried to find any content from Janos over the years that I can. It's very sparse. I know that like Joe Fiji's, like they're all, you know, everyone's obsessed with this guy that knows. I think he had written a book in Greek that had never been translated, but Joe like somehow got it translated or something. And, but this interview came out because of his record falling, some guy was like, oh, I actually have this interview with Janos that was sitting in my inbox that I never like did anything with. And basically Janos is talking about how like he doesn't, that this is a metaphysical sport and that he doesn't run for periods of 6 to 9 months at a time. Like after a race, you know, he literally doesn't run. Like he, you know, talks about the longevity of running and like that, it's more important to like sort of be ready for the mental challenge. And you know, we hear that cliche all the time in all of these sports, right? You hear the people that you look up to say it's 90% mental, but we take it as like this cliche, whereas like I'm starting to realize that it's literal, you know? And so I didn't train super hard. I wanted my body to be healthy. I moved back to Atlanta for a month and a half before the race. I spent as much time with my friends and family as I could, like just trying to feel like connected and like whole, you know? So when I went out to run the race, like in the inevitable like darkness that comes to you when you're struggling came, I felt like my cup was full of like love and like the support of like my friends and family. And like, in some ways, I think that was the most important training I did for that race, you know?
Wow.
Yeah. So I don't know. I definitely trying to like incorporate that more. I mean, I think certainly something like Cocodona or Moab, where you're looking at like 40,000 feet of climbing and stuff, you gotta like train the body, you know? And it's not saying you can't go into the, you can go into these things like totally like out of shape, but like, I think a lot of the great performances come from, sometimes they come from a place of like desperation or like wanting, you know, needing, you know, to do it, to perform like that, to like prove to yourself that you still got it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
I feel like the part that's hard for people is the perspective, on quitting and DNFing. And I've talked before, and so I won't do it now, but like I DNFed a ton, mm-hmm. right? And it was actually at Race for the Ages that I broke through.
That's awesome.
That I finally got like that point of like, can't quit no matter what. Okay. I'm through it. Okay. Yep. And like something shifted in me. Right.
Yeah.
And the things that the things that come up a lot. So there's this 24-hour race every year called World's Toughest Mudder. Okay.
Yeah.
And
yeah, and I'm also just like totally unfamiliar with obstacle racing.
Right. So imagine a 24-hour race. Yeah. So a 24-hour race of 5-mile loops. Right. And on those 5-mile loops, occasionally you're using your whole body.
Like obstacles, like
to climb over or under something, to be submerged in cold water. You're wet the whole time. Dude, you're never not wet. It's always cold. Some years it's colder than others,
right?
But it's always cold. And at about midnight, the course goes from pretty full to pretty empty.
Yep.
Because people either quit, got hurt, or just go into their fucking tent and say, I'll go out in the morning and do one more lap.
Yep.
And there's this you know, sort of standard list of excuses, right? I have nothing to prove. I wasn't having funny anymore. I wanted to not get it. People love to throw out the term hypothermia, which actually means I just got really fucking cold.
Right.
Not my body is shaking uncontrollably and like I needed help that I couldn't do myself. So it's not listening to that voice, right? No matter what, because clearly there's going to be times that, and again, I had to go through what I went through of 5 other DNFs to get to that place. So where my last few races, I didn't DNF. I mean, like I DNF'd the last man standing, I timed out, but like I didn't like throw in the fucking towel.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
I mean, first of all, DNFing is not, you know, it's not like you were saying before. I mean, it's a learning experience if you're willing to like look at it like that, you know? So there's no shame in like a DNF because it takes a lot of courage to even just show up for these fucking things, you know?
Right. But I definitely looked at it as a big failure. And I have a little thing in my craw when you say you got, so hypothermia and now rhabdo, people just throw those out like, because they just don't want to say I was really cold and I quit, which is fine. Just say that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree. I mean, I like at these races like Moab and Cocodona, you literally are seeing rhabdo.
Right. No, of course you are. Like, of course you are.
But I know what you mean. Yes. I know what you mean. And like, and that goes back to why I think like the mental training is maybe more important than the physical training. You know, Bujaral, the Mongolian guy across the years, he was hard to talk to. He doesn't speak much English. But I remember there was a couple times where I tried to engage him and just like get some wisdom from him. And, you know, he's like 40% physical training only 40%, you know, stuff like that.
Right.
And the rest of it's like meditation. It's breath work. It's all of the techniques that you can use when you are having those thoughts, you know, that like it's over for you to come around out of it, you know, because it's a perspective issue. It's like we know sort of rationally, those of us that have done these things, that like when you hit a low, if you can ride it out, there will be redemption. There will be another high. And that cycle doesn't seem to have a limit, you know, as far as I know.
But that's why only experience helps. The first time it happens, you really think you're going to die. Once you've gone through it a few times, you go, oh, okay, this is going to...
Yeah.
This is going to pass.
Yeah. But a lot of times when you're in that, even if you know that rationally, when you're in that state, it's hard to gain the perspective that this is going to pass, you know? So, yeah. But, you know, I want to run the world's longest race. And that's a lot of the decisions about which races I've been running and how I'm training have to do with that, you know?
What's the world's longest race?
It's the Sri Chimnoy Self-Transcendence 3,100-mile race.
All right, so I know that one.
Yeah, and it's, you know, a half-mile loop around a city block in Queens, New York. I think the time limit's like 55 days or something like that.
Right.
And now that I've run 1,000 kilometers in 10 days, I'm qualified for the race. But it's invite only. It's like 6 or 7 runners a year, mostly international runners. So, you know, I don't know when I'll get called up, but.
So there was a documentary made a couple years ago about it. Did you watch it?
Before I started running.
Right.
I watched the original Barkley documentary. It blew my mind.
Right.
And then I watched the 3,100 documentary and it blew my mind.
Okay.
And slowly and in indirect ways, that's where I've been heading, you know, since then.
So I interviewed the director of that movie.
Did you really?
Yeah. And I think I ended up not using it and I forget why. Maybe something happened with it. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that it's kind of surprising one hasn't been made more about it. Like you'd think certain percentage of people have heard of Barkley. even smaller percentage have heard of, you know, the transcendent race.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was going to say that's probably what's left for you to do would be that. Like, that would be more your speed than, say,
I want to do the longest stuff.
Right. Barkley is just as much about navigation as it is about the running, which is not attractive to me at all.
Yeah, I'm not a great navigator, but you know, it's
for a guy that's done the AT, the PCT, you're not a great navigator.
I mean, I'm better than like the average navigator, right? But, like, as far as, you know, a lot of the guys that do these like orienteering competitions and stuff, like, they would destroy me. Like,
right.
But yeah, my, you know, what I'm trying to keep in focus is like the Pacific Crest Trail, the Appalachian Trail for FKTs, and the 3,100 mile for racing, the longest stuff. I want all of that, you know?
Well, the AT keeps getting broken, right? Like, it keeps getting shorter.
Yeah. So my like mentor and coach, Joe McConaughey, still holds the self-supported record, which is the one I'm interested in.
Got it.
He doesn't really get enough notoriety for what he did. Unless you're in like the thru hiking circles or like really pay attention, you know, you had these guys come along, these legends. You had Scott Jurek in 2015, Carl Meltzer. And then you had String Bean beat both of their supported times, self-supported, with his pack on his back, taking care of himself every night, beat those guys with their like Red Bull sponsorships and Clif Bar sponsorships. And so to those of us that know about that record, it is the ultimate record, you know. And then there's, you know, Carl Saab came along and broke String Bean's record, but fully supported, you know.
Right.
You know, that one, that self-supported Appalachian Trail, is maybe the most impressive and stout FKT that I know of. But, you know, I have such a deep connection to that trail that I want to go for it, you know.
Which direction?
Northbound.
Because?
Because that's the way Joe did it. I mean, it's, you know, I think that it's interesting how, like, the FKTs are getting, like, very specific. Like, I have the southbound Pacific Crest Trail. I have the northbound. Pacific.
You think there shouldn't even be one?
I think it's part of the decision making and planning of like setting yourself up for success. It's like what time of year is it and what makes the most sense? Should I go north or south, you know?
But you're saying they shouldn't necessarily
designate them.
There should be one record.
Yeah. Yeah, because like, you know, if you made better decisions about like which direction to go at what time of year, then like that should count as like part of your success, you know.
Right. Well, I know your friend Allison will tell you that like people are now like snagging a segment and calling it an FKT, and it's like it's a bit. I think they finally changed it. Like, it was 5 miles for a while, and I think they bumped it to 10. And it's like,
yeah,
I feel like it should be like you got to be on your feet a while. You know what I mean? Yeah. To call it an FKT, that's the whole point.
Yeah. Well, that all started with COVID. I mean, you had all these like quote unquote just like runners, people that weren't like FKT athletes, having all of their races canceled, and discovering this new thing, you know. And so back in 2018, like, they had just moved from like some weird online forum to an actual website, you know, and now it's a huge thing.
I interviewed Buzz. He's a fascinating dude.
Buzz is awesome dude. Talk about legend,
right?
But that it's really interesting because like as that has become more popular,
you get less interested in it.
Less interested.
Right, because you're just like, you'd rather just do it.
But what you're saying about why isn't there like coverage of the 3,100 mile race, it's because like...
It's boring to watch people walk around for a month. It's also
like, these aren't the people that want the spotlight, dude. Like, you know, these are people that like could care less. Like, they don't have social media. You know what I mean? They're running in like thrift store mesh shorts. Like, they don't have sponsors.
Right.
And I'm starting to wonder if like part of getting to that level is like not going that route. You know what I'm saying?
Because your focus is just so much about the art and the discipline of running.
Yeah. And if this is like a metaphysical, spiritual sport, allowing like corruption to come into it derails you from, that's weird stuff, but you know, but I worry about it. You know, I worry about it because I've seen it in punk. I've seen it with thru hiking and what happens when like money comes into these things. I mean, there's a beauty in the fact that like when you run 100 miles, you're handed a belt buckle and that's your reward.
Right. or less, maybe a plate, maybe a piece of wood.
So what happens with something like the Tour de France, where it starts off as a bunch of guys wanting to traverse the countryside, drinking wine, and I guess at the time, like shooting heroin, but like, you know, what happens where something like that becomes this like corporate endeavor where people are like getting blood transfusions along the way so that they can win and get bonuses and like, and why do we think that wouldn't happen to like our sports, you know?
I mean, but I think with trail running, just because of the nature of it, even if Western States tomorrow became the fucking Coca-Cola Western States and grand prize was 10 grand, you're still going to find way more guys like you or even me that just enjoy getting out on the trail.
I think you're right about that.
You know what I mean? So it's just in its inherent nature. So I come from obstacle racing. And, you know, Spartan Race decided to buy these trail races.
I like how you point. It's like a Viking helmet. I come from obstacle racing, Viking helmet, monkey mask.
I mean, this just goes to show you how stupid it is, right? But the people who are really good at it are, you know, every sport says this, some of the best athletes in the world. I'm sure Ultimate Frisbee says the same thing.
Sure.
But you're talking about people who can run for distance, speed, strength, body awareness. It's a lot of things.
Yep.
Like I've always said, you know, when I watch like CrossFit is humongous. CrossFit is tiny, but it's 10 times our sport.
Yep.
And I'm like, who wants to watch people walk in their hands and jump on fucking boxes? At least with our sport, they're running. they're going 5 miles. They're going 6 miles, whatever it is. Yep. So anyway, where the fuck was I going with this? So Spartan bought a bunch of these trail races. And of course, people in the trail community are like, fuck Spartan. Yeah. And it's like, but they forget that, like, you know, that same thing. And I learned this because I like my sport's obstacle, but I have a, you know, a foot or a toe into trail. When North Face first came along, it was the same thing. And then their races became like iconic. Cool. I'm going to go do the North Face 50 or what's his name, you know, like, so people get used to whatever. But again, I think trail running in itself is so pure that you can't really.
No, I appreciate that you said that because I do forget that a lot of the time where it's like, and I really say this like wholeheartedly, the people that impress me the most, even at like a Coca Dona, are the people that are out there for 5 days doing that shit. You know, like I'm like, I don't think I could handle another night. You know, when I like finish something like that in 72 hours or whatever, it's like, you start to fear like going into another night, you know? And then you see these people crossing the line at the golden hour, you know, like the last people that come across the line. And that is like really what it's all about, man. You know, like.
Right. Well, and you talk to people who are really, really good at it or do super well. And it really is like, so I've got to talk to Maggie a few times. Right. And, if you see her at the end of when she won
Biggs,
and she was like, oh, I was kind of looking forward to doing another night with this guy, right?
Right.
Like, she's not ready to quit. She's like that's, and like, how are you so good at this? I don't know. You know what I mean? I talked to Courtney, not quite as interesting as Maggie, but talked to Courtney once, did an interview, and she's just like, I don't fucking know. You know, I'm like, you run in like the least comfortable pants I've ever seen in my life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think they actually designed some pants
they
now.
They do. They have the Solomon baggies.
Right? Yeah. So, corporate shills. No, but so it's just like, there's no, again, we always want to, it's like, again, me going to Tom Brady and saying, well, how do you throw a football or why are you so good? It's like people, it's an inside job.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you just seem to really embrace that, which I can appreciate. Plus, you know, you're a punk. So you're like, yeah, fuck these people and their money. Like, I like that about you. Right. And that's okay. You're allowed to be hateful.
Yeah.
But yeah, once in a while, me or a friend of yours is like there's always going
to
be that.
Yeah. And I don't mean to be like hateful. I just mean to like, I feel like there is room for those of us that want to critique the system, you know, and you know, it's good to have someone nagging a little bit, maybe like, you know, about like, you know, I mean, I did notice at Western States this year that every winner was immediately taken off for drug screenings, you know, and not that I think that people are doping yet. I mean, it is happening in Europe for sure in trail running.
Those Europeans, man, they cheat like fuck.
They also kick our ass at everything.
Right.
You know, it's like, I do see these little things that worry me. That's why I want to talk about it. It's not that I like feel like this like internal like fire and hate, but like, you know, I just, you know, I love it so much. you know, and it's right. one of the last really weird vestiges of like really weird shit that people do in this world.
So my friend Jeff makes videos, and he started doing a lot of stuff for me, and now he does some trail stuff, and he made this cool one about the Yetis. Mm-hmm. I don't know if maybe you saw it. He made a little documentary.
The Yeti races?
The
or like actual Yetis?
No, Yeti races. You know, Jason Green.
Yeah.
So he made a little documentary, like an hour long, about Jason, about the community. It's good. I'll send you a link.
Nice.
But like, I went to the Trail Film Festival a few years ago, and it was like a bunch of like 20-minute movies, like sponsored by Goo, right? Yep. It's basically just like somebody followed their buddy or made a little thing. And I'm like, this is not impressive at all, right?
Right.
And it's like, but on the other hand, it's like, if they are able to actually forward the sport, right? If yep. Cliff and Goo and whoever are able to put a few bucks towards it. But like I said to my buddy, I go, whatever you make next year, send to this fucking film festival, because you're certainly better than half of the ones I saw.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Just like a 20-minute video sponsored by Goo. And it's yep. like, you know, there's a stupid shot of like person eating the goo or whatever. And listen, I'm
eating the goo.
But listen, I'm a company, like I make my money on advertising.
Yeah.
Right? Like sure. If you go to my website, like you see brands and like, so it's yeah. like it's how I feed my family.
Sure.
There is a fine
yep.
line. Like I pride myself on not kissing every race's ass.
Yep.
And I've seen people do that where all they want is access and free race codes. Yep. And that's not what I want. It's probably cost me money because I've said the emperor's not wearing right. any clothes.
Right.
It's probably cost me money, but I can like sleep at night or whatever.
Yeah.
But no, we like I said, I think the nature of trail running is by nature, it's very like Ray the K's of the world of just like, hey man, this is just what I want to do and what it's about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I spent, so the way I met Ray and Joe was the first 6-day race I ran in South Carolina. That's where they live. Like all these like badass guys live in like coastal South Carolina and Florida and shit. And Ray was running, and like this guy's, you know, he's just walking and he's on his phone like the whole time, right? And so eventually I asked Ray, I'm like, what are you doing, man? And he's like, oh, he plays Pokemon Go now. Like when he's going around the loops for days on end, like he's playing Pokemon Go and collecting Pokemons. And
how could there be that? They go away, don't they, if you catch them in one area?
I don't know.
So have you written those guys? Have you written the Transcendence people?
Not yet, no.
What are you waiting on?
I don't know. I mean, it's only been a few weeks since, I mean, I'm still kind of just wrapping my mind around what happened across the year. So
is anything on the 2022 calendar actually on the calendar?
It's looking like the big thing for 2022, assuming that the weather is right, will be a Pacific Crest Trail self-supported FKT attempt.
Okay, what's the current record?
60 days.
Okay, and you think you can do it in what? 59 days and 12 hours, or you just don't
even? Yeah, I think I can beat 60 days, but I don't know. I don't know how fast I can do it.
So which ones do you currently hold? A lot?
I think pretty much all of them have been broken by someone else at this point. But at one point, you know, the ones I've done were the 100-mile wilderness of the AT, the Arizona Trail, all of Shenandoah National Park on the AT, which I was super stoked about that one because I took like 6 hours off Mike Wardian's time.
Nice.
I'm sure there's a couple other ones I don't remember right now. But yeah, I mean, that's been my goal for a long time, and it's just been pretty much impossible with the fires and
right.
Super intense winters where there's like tons of snow in the High Sierra and stuff.
Well, if you'd like to beat your two loop record of Run the ATL, I told you have like a lifetime
thanks,
free pass yeah, into thanks. My race. It's gotten a lot easier though. They cut those last.
Yeah.
Even before the trail part was put in, just when they just cut it down, it's now like that used to be the best part was that people would get to the last 4 miles and now they have to hike through.
I have great pictures of me and Andrew coming through there like chest high kudzu.
Can you send them to me? Do you have them on your phone somewhere?
Yeah. Like so fun though. You know what I mean? I actually remember because we won the first loop.
Right.
That was our goal.
I gave you a prize that one you said you split. Did one of you keep it?
Yeah. I don't know where. Was it like a railroad tie or something?
Well, everybody gets a railroad tie, but yeah. I gave you like a big giant railroad piece, like that. It's like really heavy.
Maybe Andrew has that one. But I
have to find it on my Instagram.
But yeah, that was our goal, was like, let's win the race and then do another loop.
Right. So, well, that's what you
just, and that's what we did, you know. But, you know, it was just like, it was just so cool, man. Those like train sections kind of like coming through, like, I just remember thinking like running on tracks is like a new thing for me. Cause like, you gotta like kind of stride where you hit the ties each time, you know,
and you can't for the most part.
And you can't for the most part.
Right. You try to run on the side. It's rocky.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know, man. Like it's been, you know, I don't want to put like pressure on myself. Like I kind of notice with a lot of the elite guys that try to link up like 4 or 5 big races a year, you know, it's like you might win Western States, but then you DNF the next two because you're not like giving yourself the time to like recover and prepare, you know?
Well, you said your body went like sort of through the other side, but then once it was over,
yeah,
when the 6 day was over, sorry, the 10 day, the Across the Years was over, what were the next few days like?
I actually came out of Across the Years feeling much better than I did after like Cocodona. Because like I was saying, like day 7 or 8, you start to like adjust and adapt. So like I was I walked away from Across the Years sleepy, but like physically I'm already training and running pretty strong again right now, you know, just a few weeks out from it. Whereas Cocodona, like, you know, I slept 3 hours in that whole race, you know, over 4 days or whatever. It's like, you know, that sleep deprivation alone will put you out for a month, you know, like, so, you know, I mean, that's become part of what I'm realizing is kind of like one of my goals is to like, not let these things like destroy you, but make like, you should be able to walk away from them stronger. Right. Like, and I think I learned that on the Continental Divide Trail after like 3 or 4 months of hiking, where it was like, when I hiked the AT, when I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail, you know, the last few weeks of those experiences were like my body like withering away. And it was like, I have to finish this because I'm like in full ketosis. Like I am like withering. On the Continental Divide Trail, I was able to like start thinking about like nutrition and eating like whole foods instead of just like Sour Patch Kids. And like, I walked away from the trail feeling like strong, you know, like this was a gift. Like it was like, this experience has like made me strong, like physically and mentally. And I don't want to like waste that gift. And that's why I started trail running. There's a lot of thoughts I have on like, what is actually strength? Is it like running 100 miles? Like, is that an act of strength and courage in our society? Like, not really. You know what I mean? Is running 200 miles, is running 1,000 kilometers, like the ultimate in like strength and endurance, like compared to like what most people are just going through in their day-to-day lives, like getting up in the morning and making it work for their families and stuff. Like that's real endurance. You know what I mean? Like these are just like parlor tricks, you know, honestly. And it's like the stuff that that just like the average person is dealing with takes so much strength and so much endurance. So for me, it's like these events can't be like these like vacuum sealed things. It's like, what did you learn? What strength did you gain? And how do you bring that back to like your life and the people around you, you know, your family and friends? Like how, you know, that's what the strength is about. Like, what do you have left to give after it is more important than like, did you do it?
I think it's a perfect place to end, dude.
Cool.
Good talking to you.
This is awesome, man. Yeah. I didn't know you were a tribal member.